Welcome to the Learning Reinvented podcast, brought to you by myself, James Politillo, and the team at The Learning Effect. There are lots of learning podcasts out there, so we wanted to do something slightly different. In this episode, we'll be discussing the provision of education support and learning for those who have special educational needs and disability, which you might know under the acronym of SEND or S-E-N-D. I am delighted to welcome Fiona Cuthbertson to the podcast. Welcome, Fiona. Do you want to introduce yourself to our listeners and tell them a little bit about yourself?
Hi there, I'm Fiona. I run Keystone Consulting. We are a public affairs agency, and essentially we specialise in ensuring that everybody understands and can be involved in the political process. One area that we specialise in is education, especially those with special educational needs. Because I think it's really important that all children have a effective and inspirational educational journey, and it's really important that parliamentary provision allows that.
So I presume from the fact that we're talking today, there might be some gaps in that provision, and there could be some improvement to what's happening in that space. Do you want to share a little bit about the current provision and what the challenges are?
Yeah, absolutely. The government have committed to improving education for those with special educational needs and disabilities, which is great, but there is a lot of change that needs to happen. So, for example, the funding just isn't there. At the moment, the government says that they are going to provide a notional £6,000 per student. Interestingly, in a question actually just 2 weeks ago in the Lords, it was shown to the government that actually, if you compare the number of kids with special educational needs and the notional budget that's provided, notional spending is only £4,136. So there is a massive, massive shortfall. Equally, it's interesting to note that actually at the moment, the government allows local councils to assign what they feel should be the provision for special educational needs education. That does, of course, as the government said, give councils flexibility. But what it does also mean is that they just don't have the money there for the children often. And it would be much better if there was a separate budget for special educational needs education, because then it could be ring fenced and you know that the children are getting the education that they actually need. So also you have the fact that early intervention just isn't there. So at the moment, a child might be diagnosed with an issue at 7, 8, 9. There is now real understanding that a child's education starts at birth and that the first few years are the most important. And you really do have to make sure that those children have the education and the provision that they need from the start. And at the moment, that's just not happening. And it's awful, because if you think about, you know, something completely different, like if you're planning on going to the moon, even 0.5% of a degree is potentially going to take you straight past. So it's the same with special educational needs provision. You know, if you're not putting that child on the right path immediately or as quickly as you can, then they just end up completely off beam. And it's just really unfortunate for the child, because it's not the child's fault, is it?
No, absolutely not. And I'm sure people are probably empathising with the situation. You're saying there's a £1,900 shortfall against the expected budget. And I'm sure the expected budget is not leaving you flush with enough money to do what you need to anyway. There's clearly a problem resource there. You've talked about early intervention as well. But for those people who are maybe not as familiar with the area, let's start with what are special educational needs. What might that look like for a child? How is that covered? What are the general ways of providing support to those people?
Okay, so a child with special educational needs or disability can cover a number of things. So, for example, it can cover the autistic spectrum or dyslexia, and any actual and often behavioural issues are involved in this as well. A child never wants to just wake up in the morning and decide that they don't want to learn anymore. So, but often, and 46%, I think it is, of children who are actually outside the mainstream system are kids with special educational needs. Now, provision within the mainstream system often occurs through teaching assistants, again, considering the fact that there is such an issue around funding, teaching assistants are often the first to go. But if you look at EHCPs, for example, it's actually one-to-one teaching assistants or people who are designated to that child who are the key provision. But of course, they're expensive. And again, you know, when I was talking about the £6,000, that doesn't even cover those who have really high needs and education and healthcare plans, which are often designated to those who are seen as having higher needs. So it's also because, of course, you have the fact that the local council can provide the education funding for this. It really is often completely discretionary. So a child in one area may have a teaching assistant, they might have sensory provision and all of that kind of stuff. And a child in a different area may have absolutely nothing. And they may even find themselves in something like a PRU, a pupil referral unit, because basically that's the only alternative provision that is there. And often then you are dealing with special educational needs in the same place you're dealing with children who may not have special educational needs, but may have other needs that need to be addressed. And, you know, as I say, it's the problem is simple. There is no particular standard for education. Now, obviously, you've got the green paper. The government have just finished consulting on the green paper. And as it goes, the first question is what key factors should be considered when developing national standards. But at the end of the day, without a little bit of forethought on how you must actually kind of provide the funding for those children, you are still tinkering around the edges, because standards will still not be met, because at the end of the day, the funds will still not be there. The teaching assistants still won't be able to do their job. The kids won't be able to get the education that they need. They'll just get the education that they're given. And it's just not fair.
So thinking through, there's a number of different challenges here. So funding being prime and centre to that.
Yeah.
Then having a set of standards for people to work to and be held accountable to as well. Absolutely. So that we move away from the postcode lottery type situation that you've sort of outlined, where there might be provision in one area, but you fall across the council boundary, you know, the other side of the road, and you may have a very different or lacking set of provision compared to something else. Is there also a challenge around diagnosis and, you know, people getting earlier enough support as well?
Totally. Diagnosis is a very interesting thing. So often it is the school, interestingly, who do say to a parent, have you considered the idea that your child has SEN? But even then, you know, you're leaving it up to the school, and the schools have 30 kids in the class maybe. And whilst it's much better than it was originally, you just have the silly kid who would now be the child with ADHD, or the child who can't concentrate, who's maybe the child with autism spectrum or whatever, can't focus. At the end of the day, a teacher can only see those children for the length of time that they see them, and there needs to be much more thought given around how the diagnosis happen quicker, because otherwise, you know, again, as I say, you've got children who are just not getting diagnosed soon enough, and they're just not getting the provision. And even the EHCP process, you know, you have a massive amount of money that's spent by councils basically denying people EHCPs, and 88% of them are actually found in favour of the parent. But it's such a struggle as well when you're coming to this system, just totally, it's such a struggle that a lot of parents, especially again, if you think about the parent who might have a slightly more chaotic life, they just don't have the time or energy, or even if it's as simple as both parents work full time, you know, they go to work, they come home, they hope their child has done the education that they need to do. And they're kind of constantly chasing their tail. So there needs to be much more thought about how we can actually make sure that those children get the diagnosis as quickly as possible.
Fiona, you've talked about EHCPs, which is an acronym that people may or may not be familiar with. Do you want to explain and expand on that a little bit for the listeners?
Absolutely. So an education healthcare plan is basically given to children who have higher needs. So, for example, if a child is autistic and really can't cope within a mainstream setting, in a mainstream class, needs one-to-one help, it may be designated through an EHCP. An EHCP is basically council provision. They are legally bound then to provide what is in the EHCP for that child. They're really quite expensive. But the problem equally at the moment is that education healthcare plans should actually be finalised and sorted out within 20 weeks. And that often isn't the case. Councils are often going a lot longer before they're giving the provision that they need to give to a child. And as I said before, 88% of rejections of an EHCP are actually found in favour of the parent. So really, there just needs to be the funding in place for those local councils to actually provide the EHCPs, the education healthcare plans for those children on time. Otherwise, again, you're just doing the child a disservice.
Fiona, there might be lots of people out there who are either facing this situation themselves or know people who are facing this situation. Is there any help and support out there for them to navigate through this complexity and the challenges?
Again, that's a total postcode lottery, unfortunately. So because there is no centralised system that will provide people with the help that they need, there are organisations out there who will give help, but often they obviously need to be paid for that. And it's just a system that essentially parents have to often navigate themselves. And because it's such a difficult system, and it's down to the local council as to how they organise the application even, there needs to be some kind of centralised help, because at the moment it's just a postcode lottery.
You're obviously passionate and want to change the system. So where does that passion come from for you?
My daughter is autistic. She was very lucky. She was diagnosed quite early on, and she's had a lot of early intervention. And I know how much that has helped her. And I just want other kids to be able to have that help that they need. I just don't see that it's there. And obviously through her, I've got to know other people who are in the situation. And I have friends just through politics, actually, who are in the same situation. And we all kind of tear our hair out a little bit about the fact that these children are just not given the provision that they need often. And, you know, even coming to simple facts like when you're not here anymore, and the fact that so many kids who are autistic just don't get a job. I think the figure was 18% at one point. I think it has actually come up a little higher now, because probably of more diagnosis. But you just think to yourself, that's awful. And you know, just because they're autistic doesn't make them stupid. Often autistic children have real skills about, you know, certain things. And it's just about accessing that help for them that they need, so that they can work and that they can actually have a fulfilling life, really.
And I think that's a really important message or link to make. A lot of our listeners will be in the provision, in organisations, and we talk about this quite a lot. They are helping people to transition from the education system into the work system. And the education system doesn't always set people up for work in the most effective way. And that could be whether someone has special educational needs or not. There is often a gap between those two worlds. So if someone is sitting in the corporate learning or corporate HR space or leadership space in businesses, what can they do within their own area of control to make that transition easier? or to ensure that we tap into that huge talent pool that maybe we're not doing so at the moment?
Everybody needs to understand that there is unfortunately still a stigma around special educational needs, and it really doesn't matter whether or not you're in the richest centile or the poorest centile, it can happen to you. For example, at 44 and post-chemotherapy, I had another child. It looks like he's neurotypical, and yet you'd think that the statistical probability of that was much lower, which it was. You know, obviously that was a massive shock, and we didn't really know what we were going to be expecting before we had all the tests. So, and yet here he is, and our older child, who's now 10, has all these issues where, you know, you wouldn't necessarily expect that they would be. So stigma is a big thing. Obviously understanding that there are changes that can be made, and there should be thought about how you can actually just adapt the workplace. You know, some of these, COVID has shown some places now, a child or a young person may not be able to come into a workplace, but could do everything adequately from their own space. We work with the Nisside Virtual Academy. They provide mentors for young people, and those mentors go in and actually try and just address the issues around anxiety and all of those kind of things, because often it's not actually the special educational needs that might prevent that person or you addressing and being able to link with that person. It's all of those issues around it. So just actually saying, how can we help you and how can you help us? And actually having a conversation and not assuming, not making a judgment on somebody just because of a label.
And I think it's that ability to have a conversation and not feel that you can't ask and you can't talk and you can't inquire, can't try to work and collaborate together to find solutions. Sometimes we're almost afraid to have those conversations because we feel like we're treating someone differently. And you will see lots of businesses that talk about valuing diversity of all sorts, and then there is very little done in terms of practical approaches or actual implementation or things that change. It's just lip service paid in lots of places, unfortunately.
Absolutely. And I'm afraid to say it starts with the education system. So at the moment, Ofsted obviously judge schools by grades. And if you're going to judge a school by grades, that's what the school is going to concentrate on. If you actually journey that any child might take. I mean, for example, a child equally with special educational needs, the idea that they move from one particular grade to another, even if it's not adequate in a mainstream judgment, might be huge. But it equally, you know, you do have to make sure that the system is there so that you can have those conversations. And again, there just isn't the time to have the conversations because the system at the moment is just judged on grades and where you end up and whether or not you end up coming out of your sausage factory the same as other people who are coming out of the same sausage factory, and all the rest of it, you know. And again, coming back to the strengths that children with SEN might have, you know, again, our daughter, she is very practical. She can see things very, very quickly if they're explained in a logical manner to her, if almost in a clinical way. But that means that she'd be a good project manager. She'd be, you know, good within a scientific area, maybe. She's probably not going to be a fluffy poet. Well, you know, at the end of the day, we need project managers, we need people who can make the country work, and a lot of kids with SEN are exactly the same, just in a slightly different manner, because obviously every child with SEN is slightly different.
Absolutely. And I think it's that tapping into the wider talent pool, seeing what people can do rather than what they can't do, and seeing how we can utilize every person in society to add value and feel that what they're doing is what they can do and it's the best for them, and that they're racing against their own race rather than coming out of, as you said, a sausage factory, racing a race that's not right for them. We know in the last 2 years that the things we're expected to do in society have been challenged, And I think that should flow through into every single area of life. And this is clearly an area that still has a lot of work to do.
Absolutely.
So Fiona, if anyone wants to follow you or find out more about this subject and explore it more, what should they do?
Okay, so I'm on LinkedIn, Fiona Cuthbertson. My Twitter handle is Keystone_. And basically, please do get in touch on either platform. And it'd be great to chat, because it is down to us to help those children get the education they deserve.
So Fiona, thank you for joining us today and raising the issue so eloquently and passionately. And we'll make sure that your contact details are in the show notes below the podcast. Lovely to chat to you, and thank you again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Learning Reinvented podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. If you've not already done so, please follow our podcast. And if The Learning Effect can help you and your organisation, please do get in touch. You can find both James and Katie on LinkedIn, and our contact details are in the show notes below.